It is perhaps fittingly called the case of California versus Texas at issue whether the Affordable Care Act will survive. A closer look at likely outcomes today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. At stake in a closely watched case heard yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court, something much bigger than politics, namely health insurance for more than 20 million Americans, protections from denial of coverage due to pre-existing conditions, and more. How convincing was Texas's legal case against it? A woman in Houston set to make space history with the next moonshot. And are you ready for some football? Texas voters seem to be having some second thoughts. All those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 11th day of November 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. You know, for much of the 20th century, the outlines of American life were often framed as New York versus California. The former representing the old money and its values, high finance, the establishment, the latter, that other extreme. A land that came alive after a gold rush, rising fast and making its own rules without much regard for the establishment or its formalities. In between was the rest of America, literally and figuratively. But in more recent decades, the poles of the U.S. have noticeably shifted. New York may still have the money in the markets for now, but to an increasing extent, the story of the U.S. has been written by many commentators and authors using a different shorthand. California versus Texas. West Coast progressivism versus what many see as American conservatism's last big stand, with the rest of the nation somewhere in between, if not in a literal sense. Little surprise, then, that an issue that has been contentious in the U.S. for more than a decade would reach the Supreme Court of the United States yesterday, styled as California versus Texas. At issue, something called the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, far more popularly known as Obamacare. Republicans in the Lone Star State have been leading the charge to dismantle it, but as oral arguments were heard yesterday, it was far from clear that Texas and the states that had joined it in this long-running challenge would emerge victorious. Rocky Rhodes is a professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston. He specializes in constitutional law. Professor Rhodes, welcome back to The Standard.
Wonderful to be here, David.
What are the states led by Texas arguing when it comes to why they think the ACA is unconstitutional?
You have to remember that Congress has only limited powers. Every time it enacts legislation, it has to have a constitutional power to do so. Texas is objecting to the individual mandate, and the argument to save the individual mandate when the Affordable Care Act first went to the United States Supreme Court was that the individual mandate, which says that you either have to have health insurance, you shall have health insurance, or you shall make a shared responsibility payment to the IRS, the Supreme Court in that case held that this could be upheld as within Congress's taxing power.
Uh-huh.
But of course, in 2017, the Trump administration and Congress at that time were able to zero out that shared responsibility payment. So then now, essentially, the mandate, quote-unquote mandate, says you shall have insurance or you shall pay nothing. And so Texas is claiming that because that's paying nothing, that's not a tax anymore, and therefore it's unconstitutional, it doesn't come within Congress's taxing power, and as a result, the whole house of cards of the Affordable Care Act, all 900 pages of it, has to fall.
So this has to do with severing the severance issue, severing the individual mandate from the ACA, and the issue is the rest of the ACA, and the issue is whether or not that ultimately renders the Affordable Care Act null and void because it would exceed the congressional mandate.
Exactly right. And Texas has a few hoops it has to get through. So first, and we've talked about this before, Texas has to show that they have standing, that they've actually been injured. And one of the arguments here, and there was some skepticism about this from the justices, even some of the conservative justices, is how is anybody injured by having to pay a tax of zero, nothing, right? So how is that causing an injury? And Texas has some pretty innovative and creative ways to try to argue around that, but there were some skeptical questions coming from some of the justices. And then Texas has to show that the mandate really still is a mandate now, and so that it's outside Congress's power, and it's not just a suggestion, which would be something within Congress's power, because the idea is, well, if you're just being told you either have to have insurance or you pay nothing, that seems more of a suggestion than coercion. But then if Texas can get past those two hurdles, then this third hurdle is that because of that one provision that the whole act has to fall down. And some of the conservative justices who have actually voted to strike down the Affordable Care Act before were showing some pretty deep skepticism that the whole act should come down because of that one provision at this point in time.
To be fair, it's kind of dangerous business to try to predict Supreme Court outcomes based on the questions, however, because quite often when with those questions, you're not really seeking the answers as much as you're having a conversation with other justices on the bench, right?
That is correct, and that's why I've said, you know, that they were skeptical questions, just from the types of the questions that were being asked. But you cannot always predict what a justice is going to do based on their questions. But there was a lot more in this case, very skeptical questioning, even more so than you usually see. And the questioning was mostly coming at Texas harder than it was from the California side, at least in this case.
So let's talk about outcomes. What's most likely to happen here?
Well, so there are two possibilities. One, of course, is that if California prevails, then the Affordable Care Act is upheld, and this will be the third time it survived a frontal attack, unless Congress someday down the road repeals it or amends it to a great deal through the legislative process. Of course, the other possibility is that if Texas wins, the whole Affordable Care Act is gone. And so all of the provisions, the protections for pre-existing conditions, the protections for children under the age of 26, and even the health care marketplace are gone as well. And so this has important ramifications for the Affordable Care Act going forward.
Rocky Rhodes is a constitutional law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
More people incarcerated or working in Texas jails and prisons have contracted or died from COVID-19 than in any other state. So says a report out of the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. This report was produced as part of the COVID Corrections and Oversight Project at the LBJ School. Michelle Deitch is the project's director and also a distinguished senior lecturer with the LBJ School. Michelle, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
What are the numbers here, and how did your research group come to this conclusion?
Well, we were using official numbers based on the custodial death reports that prison and jail agencies are required to file after someone dies. And we found out that there were a total of 231 deaths. 190 of them occurred in our Texas prison system, and 14 of them were from jails around the state. And then additionally, we found 27 staff deaths, and those are not reported.
Wow.
So those were ones we found through newspaper accounts.
At which prisons and jails in Texas are we seeing some of the highest reported cases and deaths?
Well, one of our stunning findings was that of those 190 prison deaths, seven prison units accounted for more than half of the deaths.
Wow.
And that's just a stunning figure. And in fact, one of those prisons actually had 6% of its prison population die from COVID.
I want to make sure that I'm not misstating this data. I'm reading that 80% of people who died from COVID-19 in Texas jails had not been convicted of a crime. Am I reading that correctly?
That is true. That is true. We have a very large pretrial jail population in the state.
But add to that, more than half of the people, as I understand it, who died in Texas prisons were parole eligible. 9 people who had been approved for parole but hadn't been released died from COVID-19.
That is absolutely true. And that's telling us that we can look to this population for trying to speed up our releases, to get out people who are the most medically vulnerable, as well as those who would present the least risk to our communities. No one's talking about releasing anyone who would be a risk to public safety, but this population would be a great target.
But that's only going to deal with part of the issue, of course. Did the report look further into the state's response and how it could improve?
This report did not. Our goal in this report was to get the data out there so that people can start having those policy discussions.
Well, the legislature is about to get together. Anything that in particular that they should be perhaps focusing on at this juncture?
Absolutely. I mean, ideally, this should have all been dealt with months ago, but it needs to be handled on an emergency basis with the legislature coming into session. We need to look at ways to reduce the prison population quickly, to get out the most medically vulnerable, but also to enable social distancing for the people that have to remain behind bars. And we also need to look at ways to better protect the people inside by making sure that they have the hygiene supplies and the cleaning supplies and the masks that they need to keep them safe.
What are other states doing to try to keep conditions from reaching where they have, what they have become in Texas?
We're going to be looking into that in a future report, but right now, one thing that our numbers show is that other states that started out with a very high number of deaths due to COVID in the prisons, they brought down their numbers of deaths. And for whatever reason, Texas has not done that, but these other states did.
So you're saying perhaps we need to take a more concentrated look at what's working elsewhere and not just focus on the situation inside Texas?
Absolutely. We need to be looking around at other states, other countries. Some of the research that we've started to do about what's happening in other parts of the world, it's stunning because this is not as big a problem in their prisons as it is here. Something about what we're doing or not doing here in Texas is making the toll devastating here.
Michelle Deitch is a senior lecturer at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin. Michelle, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for caring about this important issue.
What are Texans talking about on this Wednesday? Let's find out with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. Governor Greg Abbott taking heat for a tweet about the election related to Latino voter turnout. Via Twitter, the governor wrote, "Latinos increasingly vote Republican for the first time since Reconstruction. A Republican presidential candidate won Zapata County in the RGV." Well, Valley natives quick to note that Zapata County, the site of that wild vote swing from 2016 to 2020, lies north of the Rio Grande Valley. Diana Maldonado says, "Governor, I know you only visit the valley to campaign and attend meetings, but next time, drive through Cameron, Hidalgo, Willacy, and Starr counties so you'll see which ones make up the Rio Grande Valley." Well, in other election news, the president's refusal to extend transition resources, evidence-free allegations of fraud, and lack of a concession has folks divided on social media. Is it Trump being Trump or something more troubling? Well, we have plenty of reactions. I'll bring you those later in the show.
Yeah, a lot of people asking the question, what happened to an expected blue wave in Texas? Well, Brett Jaspers of KERA found five reasons it didn't happen in North Texas. We'll hear about that and more as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As you've likely heard repeatedly by now, Republicans retained control of state government in last week's election. But how, despite Democrats' hopes and expectations? In North Texas, KERA's Brett Jaspers found five reasons.
The first reason, much praised, is the Republicans' willingness to go door-to-door to talk to voters. The foot soldiers, so to speak, were activists like Sue Reeves of Fairview. She's a precinct chair with the Collin County GOP. We talked the week before the election.
And I've been doing a lot of block walking and weekends and weekdays.
How's it going?
Poll greeting. It's great. Very positive. Very good.
Many, but not all, Democrats refrained from going door-to-door in response to the coronavirus, but Republicans said they were able to knock, take a few steps back, and engage people. Mansfield Mayor David Cook ran for a seat in the state house that was a Democratic target in Tarrant County. Cook says he and his wife, other family members, volunteers, and up to 4 paid staffers walked the neighborhoods and hung door hangers. He said they knocked on tens of thousands of doors.
Everyone that opened the door were engaging. And I think by that point, they were ready to have some civilization and civil discussions and were welcoming to us.
A second reason for success is GOP fundraising. Democrats raised significant sums, but Republican state house candidates in North Texas largely outraised their opponents down the stretch.
Normally speaking, the budgets would be a whole lot smaller than what they were in this. You know, our budget definitely more than tripled from initial planning.
Republican groups like Texans for Lawsuit Reform, Associated Republicans of Texas, and Texans for Greg Abbott gave millions of in-kind donations in October.
At least during my time in the legislature, I know that a lot of cash came in at the very end.
Jason Villalba is a former Republican state house member and president of the Texas Hispanic Policy Foundation.
Most Republican consultants believe that it's the last mile, you know, the last 2 weeks, really, that makes the biggest difference.
Villalba also points to a third reason for Republican victories, tailoring the message to fit different House districts.
I mean, I don't think we saw a single defund the police a mail card in our district, in this district in Dallas, whereas in the suburbs and in the exurbs, I think you saw a significant push on that particular message, the defund message.
Tying their Democratic opponents to the slogan defund the police might work in some districts, but education or property taxes works better in others. Polling and, yes, block walking are ways to learn what people care about. Here's Plano-based Representative Jeff Leach talking to volunteers in early October.
Listen to them. Communicate with us as candidates what you're hearing from the voters as to what's on their mind and their heart.
Leach won re-election. He's an incumbent, and that's a fourth reason why Republicans won. Lots of incumbents. People recognize their names and often personally know and like them. And a fifth reason, there are still more Republican voters in Texas. Derek Ryan is a GOP consultant who worked on several campaigns this year. He looked at early voting data and saw a big advantage for his party.
When you start off with a plus 300,000 edge, when the results start coming in, I think that that's extremely beneficial to candidates up and down the ballot.
Ryan is curious to know who turned out on Election Day. That's data the Secretary of State will release soon. But he reckons the many newly registered voters weren't as Democratic as his party had feared.
That group was a little bit closer to 50-50 than I think that we thought it would be.
Many of the reasons for these GOP victories reinforce the old adage that all politics is local. And because this region is competitive, we can expect to see even more intense campaigning from now on. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. We hear all the time about how Texans love high school football, and one of the ways we know that's true is that they're willing to pay for it. Bond elections have supported expensive stadiums in recent years. A $70 million facility in Katy, for example, another that cost $60 million in Allen, a $48 million stadium in Prosper, just to name a few. But if Tuesday's election is any indication, Texans may be a little more reluctant to shell out big cash for a stadium. Joining us now to tell us more, Jacob Carpenter, education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
On election night, you were tracking bond elections for high school facilities like football stadiums, natatoriums, and fine arts centers. How did those fare?
So it was really interesting. This was the first year where school districts that were seeking a bond had to separate out different parts of a bond. Typically, what districts would do is roll one big package out and ask voters to approve just that one package. Mm-hmm. But this year, what they had to do is separate out certain things like a football stadium or like a swimming natatorium or a performing arts center. And what we found is that, in this first batch of results, we saw that, interestingly, voters were more likely to approve a bond proposition that was much more about rebuilding schools or new school construction or buses or technology. And they were a little bit less likely to support something like a football stadium To the point that in some places they had their kind of campus construction bond proposition passed, and yet their football or performing arts facility failed.
Very interesting that we're talking about, in a sense, giving voters a sort of line item veto, I suppose you could say, of sorts. The state legislature passing a bill, I guess it was 2019, that allowed voters to pick and choose which parts of a bond package they supported. How big of a factor was that in some of these stadiums falling short on election night, do you think?
In some of them, it was probably a very small impact. We did see some places where the difference between kind of the more campus construction bond, really only surpassed by a couple percentage points. But we did see that there were some places where it was a huge difference. Here in Lamar CISD in the Houston area, it's a district of roughly 30, 40,000 students. They passed their big construction bond, fast-growing district, by about 67%. And their stadium only got 46%. That was going to be an $80 million stadium. So we did see that there were several districts where it was the difference between passing and failing. Every single district that we looked at, it was a small sample, but every one of them, the stadium vote was lower than the more traditional construction vote.
Of course, one election season does not a trend make. Sounds like something Yoda might say, but pulling back just a little bit, do you think we're seeing a broader shift in how people approach public school spending, or is it too early to tell, do you think, Jacob?
Yeah, and that's a big question of, we are in a time of coronavirus where I'm sure there are a lot of voters who are a little bit more uncertain about their finances and wouldn't be too excited about, building something like a new football stadium. There was a new part of the law as well that required to put on there on the ballot that this would be a tax increase, even if it wasn't necessarily a tax rate increase. And so I think that given that it was a pretty small number of districts that went out for a bond in the middle of the pandemic, that there is so much financial uncertainty, I think it's too early to say that, this will be a long-term definitive trend. But again, we saw it across every single district that did go out for a bond. So I think it's definitely worth watching as more districts try to build these types of projects.
And Jacob Carpenter will be watching it. He is an education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas has set a new single-day high for confirmed coronavirus cases. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie reports the state is also the first in the nation to surpass a million COVID-19 infections, according to Johns Hopkins University.
Texas Department of State Health Services reported 10,865 new infections on Tuesday, a one-day state record. The previous high mark was set on July 15th. Health Department spokesman Chris Van Dusen says it's likely some of the new cases can be traced to Halloween gatherings. There is, however, a significant ongoing surge in West Texas. Emergency rooms in El Paso are overwhelmed with patients, and the county's brought in mobile morgues to deal with the rising number of deaths. Roughly 1 out of 10 coronavirus infections in the nation have been recorded in Texas. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
Meanwhile, mobile medical tents will go up at Lubbock hospitals this week as facilities continue to deal with a surge in COVID-19 patients. They make up more than 22% of all hospitalizations in the area. Covenant Health's regional medical officer, Dr. Craig Ryan, says the situation is dire.
The general public does not seem to understand that this is reaching crisis proportions.
In Amarillo's trauma service area, COVID-19 patients account for 30% of all hospitalizations. Immigrant advocates are concerned another group of Cameroonian asylum seekers near Fort Worth may soon be deported. KERA's Mallory Falk explains dozens of others at the Prairieland Detention Center were sent back to Central Africa last month.
That first deportation flight took off from Alliance Airport in October. Advocates said several of the asylum seekers aboard had filed a complaint that they were physically abused and forced to sign deportation papers at a detention center in Mississippi. Then they were transferred to Prairieland and eventually deported. Rebecca Entralgo is with the advocacy group Freedom for Immigrants, which recently helped file a new complaint on behalf of six more asylum seekers in Louisiana.
Of those six, four have been transferred to Prairieland, and we believe that from what we've heard from their attorneys, the people in detention have been told that there is likely another flight scheduled for sometime this week.
Amnesty International has asked the U.S. government to halt deportations to Cameroon, saying returnees risk jail, torture, and even death. And Entralgo says some of those flown out in October have gone into hiding, and two were immediately jailed in Cameroon.
That's Mallory Falk reporting. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from HipCamp, an online resource for booking camping, glamping, and RV stays in the U.S., connecting nature lovers with landowners. Learn more about hosting at hipcamp.com/land.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Just as the name Apollo became synonymous with NASA's moon landing half a century ago, it could be the name Orion will become synonymous with another first, the first woman on the moon. The woman whose mission it is to make that happen is NASA's Katherine Koerner. She is the head of the Orion program, which is based in Houston, and her background is in aeronautical and astronautical engineering and human health. In fact, she's the first woman program manager for Orion, which has been in place for some 13 years, evolving over those years. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Men have gone to the moon before. Why not a full female mission, since so many women, as I understand it, are qualified to go?
So our astronaut corps is fairly diverse, and that core is what we select from when we choose our astronauts for any given mission. It's very possible that we will have more than one woman returning to the moon at some point in the future, but as far as I'm aware, the plans are to have at least one woman and the next man on the surface of the moon by 2024.
Is there any particular thinking behind that combination? Was there any particular thought given to having a mixed gender crew?
You know, the assignments for the crews are done based on the skills needed to accomplish the mission at hand. We do know that the likely person that will be making that trip will be somebody within the astronaut corps today who's currently working on a variety of NASA projects. The actual mission design is ongoing, and so we don't have details just yet about what they're going to be doing day in and day out while they're on the lunar surface.
What is it that you're hoping to do with a return visit?
So a lot has changed in the last 50 years, both in technology as well as in our understanding of the human as a system in a microgravity environment. We learned a lot of that on board the International Space Station. So when we return to the moon, we're going to explore areas we haven't been to before. We're looking for different types of science, geology, as well as resources that we can potentially mine and use for other NASA missions, as well as potentially return to the Earth to make great scientific discoveries.
Is there any serious consideration of establishing some kind of ongoing presence on the moon as we have had in orbit around the Earth?
We are looking to use the moon as a way station to not only help us learn how to live and work on another planet when we're a little bit closer to home than Mars is, but also give us the opportunity to help develop the systems that will be needed for a long journey to Mars. You know, I use the analogy sometimes of a car ride. If you're going on a car ride that maybe 40 minutes, you take one set of things in your car and you probably don't even have to check to see if you have enough gas. If you're going on a four-hour drive, you might have a few more things in your car and you might be planning your mission or your trip a little bit differently. Well, if you're going to go on, for example, a four-month car ride, you might want something more like a mobile home type of an activity, right, for that kind of an adventure. That's kind of the difference between going to low Earth orbit, going to the moon, and then going to Mars. They're very different. And so you can learn from one in order to better be successful on the other.
What do you attribute your interest and love of space to? Were you one of those kids around the TV set watching those early moon landings, or not so much?
Absolutely. I remember Apollo 11, and I remember my parents getting really excited about it. And I thought, goodness, why is this such a big deal? Of course we can put people on the moon. We can do anything we set our minds to as Americans, right? It held a fascination for me, right? It's something that everyone can get behind and everyone can get encouraged by. And it really can stimulate our economy as well as an interest in the love of science. And so it was those early Apollo missions that really sparked my interest. And those have just grown over the years.
Half a century from now, do you think Orion may indeed be synonymous with the first women on the moon? Since, I mean, your fingerprints will be all over this program and those of the first female astronaut to step foot on the moon.
That is my hope and my desire. You know, when I first started in this industry, I was one of only a handful of women, and now women are infused throughout all of the agency and in positions of responsibility and technical authority. And so it's exciting for me to see what has changed in the last 50 years, and I'm excited to see what can happen in the next 50 years.
What is the one thing you'd like Texans to know about this mission, your mission?
You know, I would like them to realize that they have had a part in this mission. Everything that we do here at the Johnson Space Center builds on the past history of this great state, and it's going to continue to build on the technologies and the industry that we have here in Texas.
She's bringing new meaning to the question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Sending the first woman and man crew to the moon, Catherine Koerner leads NASA's Orion program out of Houston, Texas. Ms. Koerner, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, who recognize the role caregivers play in helping patients fight cancer. With more than 200 locations, Texas Oncology and caregivers can be right here for cancer patients. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Typically, this day would be marked with parades and get-togethers in honor of those who've served their country in the military, many giving their all. But on this Veterans Day 2020, a pandemic is keeping even loved ones apart. Texas Standard managing producer Laura Rice is thinking about her grandpa, who served in two wars. She recorded this interview with him in 2015.
My real name is Leland Thomas, but I go by Lee Thomas most of the time. But a lot of people back in during the time I was in service called me Sergeant. And when I was in the Air Force, during the early 50s, 1953 and 54, I was in the Korea during that time, and I was in the Army, yes, at that time. We came in the Air Force in 58, and the Vietnam War really didn't start until 63. But I was over there the first time, took pictures, motion picture and still, of all the activities that they wanted to take pictures of.
Can you tell me about the planes leaving Vietnam?
Yeah, it was in April of 1975. And we had to go in and see how many people we could get out that were on our side. And not only American people, but the people that had worked with the Americans, like the Vietnamese. We had at least 15, but I think maybe more like 18 C-130s that came in from the Philippines. All seats had been removed, and they told them to just sit down, scoot together. It was no longer Saigon. It was after that, it was now called Ho Chi Minh City.
And of course, there were so many people that weren't able to get on those planes.
Because they knew that the North Vietnamese was going to be overrunning us real soon. And those kids didn't have any idea how they was going to live through the night or what was going to happen to them. But there was also a boat person. There was several boat people. There was a lot of teenagers there and a lot of people there that, whether they worked for the government or not, went out on Navy boats and ships and things like that. And one of those ended up being our daughter-in-law. She was a teenager when she got come over there, but our son, he later on met her and married her, and they lived in Florida for the longest time.
Now, since we're telling the hard stories, I know one of the other hard stories that you had was bringing home the POWs. Was that from Vietnam too? Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that was from 1973, because in February the 14th in 1973, and I'm thinking about this one individual. It was a big, tall Marine, very tall and skinny Marine, but he had been brainwashed so much that he was just not with it. He couldn't understand what was going on. He was given an American flag, and he took it, but he didn't know what it was. It's almost like, what is this, and what's it for? Because he was being led around by another Marine. And all those guys were on their way back to freedom. And see their wives and families, and that's the reason I'm always wondering whatever happened to this guy, whether somebody did show up for him.
Now, you had a wife and some kids at home. Were you afraid sometimes that you weren't going to see them again?
I wrote more last letters than I could even count anymore. Because sometimes when I'd go out on a job, I'd write a letter to be found in case it needed to be. But I'd tear it up when I got back. And maybe 2 weeks later, I'd write it again. Because I said, if anything happens, you just go ahead and get remarried and go ahead and go with life.
Retired Air Force Senior Master Sergeant Leland Thomas speaking with his granddaughter, Texas Standard Managing Producer Laura Rice. Many Texas schools are now open to in-person instruction, but that means many Texas teachers are simultaneously teaching students in the classroom and online. Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips takes us to a district in San Antonio where she reports the added workload is putting an additional strain on most of the teachers.
This year has been exhausting for Stephanie. She's a preschool teacher who agreed to share her story on the condition that we only use her first name. Stephanie starts class each day with a morning meeting. They sing a song and talk about the day's schedule while she moves around the room and gets her 7 in-person students to do jumping jacks.
A lot of what I do is movement-based in order to keep, 4 and 5-year-olds' attention.
She drags a cart on wheels around with her with an iPad on a tripod placed on top so she can live stream and record the meeting for her 11 remote students.
The morning message I can do and kind of like involve everybody.
But after that, things get difficult.
There are many times where what I'm doing with the in-person students, it doesn't really necessarily include, it isn't inclusive.
Stephanie says many activities require supplies and support students may not have at home. And she can't monitor her in-person students' progress when she's talking to remote learners.
I try to give them all the same effort and the same attention. And I can't do that. I can't do that. I'm having to choose between my in-person kids or my virtual kids.
Stephanie's district, Northside ISD, is San Antonio's largest, with more than 100,000 students. Superintendent Brian Woods says he originally wanted to assign some teachers to be in person and others to be remote.
We knew this was going to be an issue way back in April. And so we thought for a long time about how do we prevent that from happening, knowing that it would be a challenge.
The district ultimately decided it was more important to avoid changing a student's teacher during the year.
We really thought that would be detrimental to the student. And we heard from a number of teachers who said, I don't want kids moving in and out of the class all the time. I want to know them well, and I want to understand their needs. And that makes good sense.
Wood says there's probably some, quote, legitimacy to the concerns of teachers like Stephanie, who say students are losing out because they can't give them their full attention.
We're all in a situation here where we're choosing between a series of options, all of which are bad. And so it's a matter of finding the least bad option.
But Stephanie says the district's least bad option leaves many teachers, especially early childhood educators like her, feeling stressed out and stretched thin.
I don't think it's healthy or normal for me to cry on my way to work and to dread going into work at a job that I I used to love.
She says she's lost the energy and motivation to do the things she used to do for fun. She also started seeing a therapist.
Honestly, I don't see a way out, and I don't ever want to get to the place where nothing has changed and I have to decide whether, you know, my mental and physical health is worth this job.
Teachers are leaving. Chris Contreras is a Northside ISD middle school teacher. He says three of his colleagues have already left since the start of the school year.
Just decided to call it quits, young and old. We've had many teachers who expressed this as their last year. I'm not ready for that yet.
Still, he compares teaching right now to trying to cook three meals at once. Something has to give, he says, but he's not sure what the solution is.
I would guess have all the students come back. That would be the best thing. Have everyone come back. But have the testing in place. Have the PPE in place. Have the safeguards in place.
Northside ISD Superintendent Brian Woods says he'd also like to have more students return to school because many of them are struggling to learn remotely. But the coronavirus pandemic is far from over, and he's promised parents they can stay virtual all year if they want to. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says that Austin has become one of the most dangerous cities in America. Is that a fact? Joining us now, Brandon Mulder of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Now, I imagine this claim has something to do with Austin reallocating police funding. Am I right? What's the context for this claim?
That's correct, yes. So about 2 weeks ago, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and other Texas leaders, they went to Houston and they held a press conference during a Back the Blue event where they continued vocalizing their support for police officers. And they talked more about their plans for a state takeover of policing in Austin, a city that Patrick called a disaster. And you're right, this is all in response to the Austin City Council's recent decision to cut $150 million from the police department budget.
In fact, I understand we have a little bit of tape. Let's take a listen.
The city of Austin is a disaster if you haven't been there. A great city. Now one of the most dangerous cities in America and definitely in Texas. We've already been talking with the governor, and I've talked with others about taking over Austin. The state taking over policing that city.
That's Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. So, Brandon, how do you go about assessing a claim like this? One of the most dangerous cities in America and definitely in Texas, he says.
Well, first off, we don't exactly know what he means by dangerous. A city could be dangerous for any number of reasons, like, for instance, its vulnerability to natural disasters. But considering the context in which this was said, which was a Back the Blue event, we're assuming he means crime is making Austin dangerous and that crime is up in the city because police funding is down. And the policy experts we spoke with took this to mean that violent crime specifically was up, the kind of crimes that would make you fear for your personal safety. So we're talking things like murder, aggravated assault, sexual assault, kidnapping, etc.
Well, now, let's pull back for just a moment, because I know I read something in the Austin American Statesman reporting that murders had reached a new record hasn't been that high since, something like 1997 or so, something along those lines. And we've been hearing a lot lately from Texas Republicans criticizing Austin's police budget cuts by pointing to high crime. And we just spoke a couple of weeks ago about a related claim from Governor Abbott. How does Patrick's comment compare?
Well, that's correct. And you know, murders are up this year. But Patrick's comment is more about comparisons to other cities across the U.S. So the way we looked at this was we looked at FBI data. The FBI keeps a repository of all crime data from police departments across the country. Last year, Austin reported about 4,000 incidents of violent crime. So that's a rate of about 400 crimes for every 100,000 residents. Now, for comparison, the city with the highest violent crime rate in the country last year was Detroit, which had a violent crime rate that was more than quadruple Austin's. So among the largest cities in the U.S., Austin ranked 28th for violent crime. So that's nowhere near the top of the list. And Austin wasn't near the top of the list in 2018 or 2017 either.
Of course, the 2018-2017 preceded the change in police budget funding. And I think we should point out, too, that the homicide rate was on an upward trajectory before Austin City Council made any changes to the budget and has yet to fully implement those changes. Is there enough information for a ruling yet, do you think?
Yeah, so we rated this pants on fire. There's just no evidence to suggest that Austin is one of the, quote, most dangerous cities in Texas, let alone the entire country.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick's claim that Austin is one of the most dangerous cities in Texas and the U.S. pants on fire, that ruling from Brandon Mulder with PolitiFact Texas. Brandon, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring social media on this Wednesday. Welcome back, Wells.
Good to be back, David. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the president's refusal to extend transition resources to President-elect Joe Biden, much less concede the election, has folks divided on social media. Is this just Trump being Trump, as some have put it, or something more? As the president continues to make evidence-free allegations of election fraud, installs new friendly leadership across military positions, and even continues planning for another annual budget, per reporting from the Washington Post, folks are just asking what the president is up to here. Here's a sampling of the responses we're seeing on Facebook. Jose Fonseca says he will leave in January no matter how much he drags his feet. He says, I don't live in a media bubble, so I'm not worried or outraged by this, although I do think he'll run in 2024 and could have a shot at winning. Deborah Kraft-Lilly says she's not surprised by how Trump is handling his loss, and she notes that he has another helper in our Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, just heard about him, who's offering a reward of up to $1 million from his campaign fund to report voter fraud. The Lieutenant Governor decidedly making some waves with that yesterday. Meanwhile, this perspective from Craig Hartley. He says, I hate conspiracy theories with a passion, but it appears Trump might be trying to stage a coup to stay in office. Aside from the meritless lawsuits and refusal to follow centuries-old guidelines on transition, he's refusing Biden access to top-level briefings, whipping his cultists into a frenzy, and removing government officials and replacing them with loyalists. Many people taking issue with that note that Biden is not receiving the presidential daily brief. I believe that is common when there is a new president-elect. And so some people raising the possibility that this could be a danger, essentially, that if they're not prepared once Joe Biden does take the office of the presidency. So lots to chew on there and lots of concern out there, if we're being honest, David.
Well, coups and cultists. I mean, the words definitely raw, and a lot of raw emotion and feelings out there. I have been reading some speculation. I believe this was from the New York Times today, talking about how a transition might happen that might be something less than a coup. One scenario would have President Trump retreat to Mar-a-Lago and just sort of vacate. And we have heard about his efforts to start up a political action committee, something that might go at least some distance toward retiring campaign debts, although I believe it's being framed as advancing some of his larger goals. But he has yet to concede the election. So, that's where we stand as of this Wednesday.
As with so many things with the presidency, I mean, there is we're seeing really these guardrails that have been there on the presidency were basically a set of norms that we've heard so much about. And so absent those, if you have a figure that doesn't respect those norms, it raises the question of how do you go forward from here? And we're witnessing history in the making here, David.
Speaking of going forward, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org 24/7. And of course, we'll be back here for the big broadcast tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the team, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund.
For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.